We've been leading this teacher training, and it's got me in the mind, especially of how to properly care for people that you're teaching and trying to support, and what I want them to know, what I want, how I want to take care of them, and also just keeping myself in check, making sure that they're safe, making sure that I'm safe. Mm-hmm. And it ties into a topic that you and I have been dancing around, I think, lately, which is that I have this, one of the main things that I feel especially driven to try to do for them that I don't know was done for me as much as I wish it was, is to really encourage them to be gentle with themselves. And I think I did some damage to myself in my early meditation career by just some simple, stupid, bad habits that I don't think I was warned about. I just didn't know. And it would have been nice if someone could have warned me, and maybe they couldn't have. And I didn't know because they couldn't have warned me. But
And also early spiritual career, really, meditation, yes, and maybe the way an idea like renunciation or asceticism is held, and how, you know, any mm-hmm. any subject could get twisted in those early days. And indeed, I went through that and was harsh on myself. So pretty relevant topic still to this day. So,
And I don't want that for them. I want to
short circuit
encourage
that.
People. Yeah, especially as early as you can catch them. There are people who have never really sat and I'm going to cough. Pardon me. I should have pressed my cough button. It's okay. I don't have a cough button. But people do that. Real podcasters do that. But I don't. I just cough.
I want a cough button. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I want, especially like new meditators, I want them to like it. And I did I meditated for a lot of years, a lot of hours without really liking it, because I thought it was good medicine that I should take. And I think that was one of the worst habits that I developed, was my ambivalence towards my meditation cushion.
Yep.
And I just can't, you can't, what I'm trying to say now, the argument that I'm trying to make now, is that you can't have the long-term goals of spiritual practice of whatever type, that they are inaccessible to you if you can't find ways to enjoy, find gratification, fulfillment, enjoyment, even pleasure, I dare say. If I can bleed into the realm of what could be controversial in this discussion, that you don't have access to those. If you don't have access to those feelings about your practice, then you don't have access to the long-term benefits of practice, because you're going to avoid it. Yeah. You're going to find ways to get around it.
And you're focusing primarily so far upon meditation, and obviously that bleeds out into how one, the practice of doing the dishes, which will be a thing one has to do every day generally, or the practice of sweeping a room, and the general self-hate that I've carried into even domestic work or my work life, or a kind of, oh, I wish this was over, or any kind of a seeking pleasure and enjoyment in everything from meditation on up. You know, our day maybe begins with meditation, then on up. So it seems applicable to many things, but we can stick to actual just meditation, you know, because I had the same experience. I didn't enjoy it for years. Yeah. I don't say I always enjoy it now, but it's a time for me to sit still and be alone. And with the pleasure in that, the pleasure in just, and you said one thing to me when you visited here 6 or 7 years ago, and it was terrible. You know, you're asked sometimes in meditation to focus upon the breath, or to take an object of meditation. Sometimes we're asked to do that. And then the mind forgets it, and then I have to bring it back to it. And I would always forget the object all the time, quickly, right away, and sometimes for long periods of time. And I'd always feel bad when I remembered it. And then you said, no, that's when you feel good, because you just remembered it. Like, do not label the loss of that object. Don't sweat it. If it was 30 minutes off the object and you had that last breath was on, great. And that does help increase a sense of benefit. Like you, because one will do it more with that. It's so lovely to like, I was just thinking about my breakfast for like, I don't know how long, like a long time there. I just went off, or then I went on streams of thoughts, and then I brought it back to the breath, and then to rejoice. You use the word rejoice too. And that really, really helped me out. And I mean, I heard that in my 40s. That's something I needed right from the get-go.
Yeah, me too, I think.
Badly, very badly.
I remember walking in to you, the little house that you were renting in the middle of the desert. And you had just gotten up from a meditation. And I just remember you being so calm that I was like borderline annoyed. Not at you, per se.
per se.
And I'm like, damn. I don't look like that. Like, his meditation must be working, because I don't look like that when I get up from meditation. When I get up from meditation, I'm like, oh, thank God. You know, like if you had interrupted, like I think I interrupted your meditation. You're like, no, man, I was right at the end. Don't worry about it. Here, let me make us some coffee or tea or whatever. Hey, man. Hey, dude. You know? Yeah. And right, if you had interrupted my meditation, I'd be like, oh, thank fuck. Oh, good. You're here. Here. Now I can make some tea or some coffee.
That's better than my old habit, which was interruption. Like, you've interrupted my sacred meditation, which of course is something I had to let go of pretty early on with family and stuff. But so, or what you did, you know, either one could happen. Like, oh, good. Someone just interrupted me. Now I don't have to finish the last 15 minutes of this hopeless thing. And then, do I relate with all that.
But I bet you kind of like doing the dishes. I imagine you kind of liking doing the dishes. Am I off base here?
No, and it's kind of a recent victory. It's taken a little bit of time to see the stuff of daily life as, to use that word again, portals into some kind of peace and awareness. And not fighting them, because I grew up in a realm where we were always trying to not have to do those things. Mm-hmm. And God bless my mother and my father, but often it seemed that the cooking and the cleaning, it was all a drag. And bless her heart, of course it's sometimes a drag. But I really have tried to carry the meditation or whatever peace or love we feel into, then like, can we pick up tools without that aggravated utilitarian get her done quick kind of energy? Like, it's hard to the imprint of aggression in my body, wherever it comes from, a European genetic karma, however it is, the world that we're in feels rather violent and rather tends towards, your mind wasn't on the object. What is your problem? You've been doing this 5 years and you can't even follow your breath 5 times. You're hopeless. Yeah, right. And the voice is powerful, and it comes in, why are you having to do so many dishes? You also cooked. Any of the violence that comes in, it seemed at some point in my life almost ubiquitous, as if I carried some impression of aggression in my actual DNA, spiritual and other or otherwise. And so I'm really glad you brought this subject up, because it still continues to haunt my bones and my mind.
Oh, me too.
Totally.
And I don't want that for other people. And I'm like sharing this, you know, I'm just so like eager having these little, you know, training, they're nothing little about them. They're, you know, grown ass people, but, you know, these little trainees, you know, you think of them like that because they're new to some of these practices. Yeah. Like it's so like, I so desperately am trying to teach them skills I don't have.
I don't want them
to be like me that way. I don't want them to have the self-abuse factor, and it of course it extends to other things. I mean, it's a huge element of meditation, and it's the most common thing in the world, right, to be pissed off when you realize you forgot you were supposed to be meditating. And and it's an impediment to meditation. Well, being someone who hasn't meditated or who doesn't know how to meditate is an impediment to meditation, but then you train the mind, and the joyfulness has to be a part of the training of the mind. But like trying to be a good person, right? A nice person maybe is a better way to put it. I don't know. It's a similar process, of course, where we are learning to self-scrutinize. And by that process of learning to self-scrutinize, we have a tendency to be really hard on ourselves because we make these discoveries. And I have this, you know, this thing that I say to people that's almost rote now, you know, that, but it's not an empty platitude. It's like this thing I'm like begging of people: when you notice that you've missed the mark, when you notice that you've fallen short of the mark, that's not what makes you special. That's true of everyone on your block. Right, did something silly today or mistaken or hurt somebody today. And that doesn't make you special, but the fact that you're interested in it is what makes you special.
And yeah.
And how do you get, but then, so, you know, I'm saying, so you should be happy when you notice that you did something, you know, naughty or not in line with what you want to do. And it's just hitting me today as I'm trying to tell another group of people this thing. Like, well, it sounds easy enough, but boy, it's not how my mind works. That would also really take some training to be. It is not the natural state to notice that I just, you know,
hurt somebody,
whatever. I was going to say pooped on the coffee table, but I think your example's better. And be like, yippee.
And then I even say around that awareness, which we're attempting to label as how wonderful that this occurred. I'm aware. I'm in the game. I'm in the running. This is the thing. And within that, that is also has to be a gentle act in the sense of this. We don't always know when we harm others. Sometimes we think we've harmed others and perhaps we haven't. Sometimes we think we've helped others and perhaps we've harmed. So even asking for the blessing for the ability to discriminate between what is harmful and unharmful, the difficulty of that, and then being gentle even around that inability. Just that to me also is important for me to bring in, because sometimes, I don't know, sometimes we've helped others without even being aware, or we've harmed, and the other two options, right? It feels to me that has to be a part of it. Like, it's not always clear. It just isn't always clear.
Well, and I've been playing with this thought technology, as you know, of my sort of a helplessness that I find myself doing things before I planned to do them, before I knew I was going to do them. And right, of course, the power of decisiveness, the power of decision, the power of will that I have over things is, let's call it unclear at best. Dubious, maybe. It's not clear how much power I have. So then I see myself do something weird, and it's because I did it to some extent. It's because I did it weird last week, and I did it weird the week before, and maybe my mom did it weird, or my dad did it weird, or my preacher or my teacher did it weird because their mom did it weird, or their dad or brother or sister or, and, you know, give me a break, man, you know, like, okay. And so then I did the thing weird and like, how gnarly am I going to get myself with it? It's like, I'm trying to swim against the momentum of all of eternity, of all of God's creation, of God herself, to act differently than what is in motion. And A, if there were such a thing as that, then I can't.
Yeah.
And B, if I do somehow act, at the same time, I don't deserve all the blame if I am helplessly acting in line with what I was made to be. I also don't deserve all the credit, right? There's some momentum that represents the reason I didn't, you know, punch a monkey or whatever, punch a baby or whatever, you know, I don't do that, but whatever bad thing that I don't want to do. Also there's some momentum that allowed me to stay my hand or bite my tongue or my lip or be the Shanti Devi and bump on a log. Don't react for a moment.
Remain still.
Yeah.
Passing don't. Cloud. Watch cloud.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's also only because of some momentum, I want to say, which is, you know, it is like a grace, that momentum.
Yeah.
You see, one could look at it that way. One might want to make an argument that we call it grace when we do the right thing for some seemingly inexplicable reason. There is some pathology that we could trace out that is difficult and obscure, esoteric, right, path which we could trace to why we acted well that day. But I don't know, just suddenly I didn't yell back.
And the obscure path perhaps was in a Christian context. There is something and there is a momentum power in the awareness of grace. There is, and it starts to push into perhaps a causal language. And I push back against it. And yet there is something about Jesus Christ in the gospel saying, do not call me good, only my Lord in heaven is good, my Father in heaven, only my mother in heaven. However, we want to speak of this ultimate being that clearly does not have genitalia. So that source, any goodness you see in me comes from that source. Now that doesn't negate the self. It seems to negate a kind of anxious or false self potentially. And there's some deep self-love in the act of desiring to see goodness coming through us as grace and not my little self. There's an ecstasis. There's a standing outside of self in a healthy way that can happen, and an ecstasy, a standing beyond or other. There's in the awareness that grace is doing the work, and it just sounds wrong. There's a very difficult thing to discuss this one because it seemed our teacher in Buddhism, which we had for many years together, would speak look, we don't have to talk really about grace. That's what's going on, you know, and yet then to enter into another tradition like Christianity, it seems that half of the path involves that awareness of grace. And of course, there could be arguments made that in fact is a big, big part of Buddhism or other paths. And so I'm not trying to, I'm just saying how I in fact internalized it and how it presented in my life. So
I think that's right.
So, but something in this awareness of grace that is just, it liberates the will to undergo actions of kindness without a sense of merit or tit for tat, as if you're a vessel that's receiving a groove that is already there, almost like when the music comes. You don't have to play the groove. The groove is there. It plays you. It doesn't, and somehow saying that and being and giving obeisance to that, it does create a momentum, maybe.
Well, and I'm trying to get people to give themselves a grace of, yeah, I don't know the opposite. And I don't know. I had this idea in the back of my mind that you were going to make an argument that when we are that the momentum by which we miss the mark is also some sort of grace. Like, I know that you talk about the cross as a way of bearing what is before us and what is, to be simple or whatever, what is challenging before us or what we might otherwise
bearing and transforming. Yes, transforming. Yeah. by the cross. Yeah,
right. But you know, does that include, and here I am maybe trying to make the argument that I fantasized you were going to make, does that include then our misbehavior, that the momentum, just like the momentum by which we mysteriously seem to meet the mark in a moment is a sort of grace, is there a grace to the momentum by which we miss the mark? Is that
miss also, the mark, the very definition of sin, that is the Grecian definition.
Is there a grace to sin? I mean, isn't that momentum? Because that seems like, to me, it seems like a starting place. And it seems like a starting place in Buddhism. It seems like a starting place in Christianity. Like
Genesis, the story comes pretty quick. And, you know, Felix Culpa, the blessed fall that St. Augustine refers to, like, oh, bless the Lord that I sin. Oh,
I think I went to high school with him.
It was St. Augustine.
No, Felix Culpa.
Oh, Felix. Oh, yeah. Felix. Felix meaning right, felicitude, like good, and then culpa. You know, yeah, this blessed, you know, fall, this blessed culpability, and that really starts to turn self-hate on its head. It really starts to be, ironically, the awakenness of our fallen nature. It can be a deep blessing, and what you bring up, then it really does start to transcend that habit. That would really unloosen it. You know, even my fumblings today. But you couldn't quite, now in Christianity, we couldn't quite say that those come from God.
That
my boo-boos, my my boo-boos, they're yours alone. And I would like to push back against that with you.
Good.
And keep going down this very interesting road of.
It seems in the beginning, it seems there's, I mean, and this can't be right. Okay. I mean, it seems like there's more of that than the other, or that's the starting state. So, but we don't want to say somehow sin is winning over grace in the beginning. That doesn't seem right.
Yeah, Paul warns us, or that we should then be praying to sin so that we can see we're sinners and fallen people.
Whoa,
so that,
blech. Yeah, right.
That would be, I don't. That's a boo boo.
No, and there's this Buddhist idea that suffering is our friend because it hurts or whatever, because suffering will get us out of the cycle because it's painful. But if it weren't, then what do I need to get out of the cycle for?
Right.
So, but then there is, okay. So then I'm also trying to, so I don't know. I don't know if we figured it out. I don't know if we cracked the problem. So
not
I don't want to move on prematurely. Okay, good.
Not at all.
I don't want to move on prematurely from out of frame sin or missing the mark or the overwhelming momentum of the careless acts that I do as somehow being to my advantage, as somehow being a grace to my advantage. I don't know. It'd be nice.
Certainly a grace if we see the actions as careless.
Boy, that's a big if. But yes,
certainly a grace if we see the actions. And then I think it's beautiful to engage in prayers that, you know, I do not know today who I have helped, who I have hurt. Please, God, reality, truth, make strong in me, you know, those actions which help others, and please try to reduce those other actions, the ones I can't even, like, take care of that, sort of cover the bases, because, but I'm more interested in going back to what you said about, it's really like once we catch ourselves in an act that causes harm, how can we then see that as grace manifest? You see? And to me, it almost, it's built in. If we've caught the boo-boo, that's huge. That's, and I think where it gets interesting is instead of going into, oh, I lost the object of meditation, that day that you told me to rejoice. Rejoice, you remembered the object. Don't think about how long you were off it. So to me, there's almost like beyond all, you feel filled with hope then. There's not this hopeless sense that I'll never hold the object. And maybe it doesn't even matter as extremely as you thought. You even hold your inabilities around your meditation practice, or you hold those inabilities as portals. Like, I'm stuck here in the body. I don't do this. I am. Oh, I'm noticing that I'm terribly distracted. And then literally seeing them all as messages, because they are. Ultimately, everything is a seed from the love of God. And ultimately, everything we think, do, and say plants a seed for the future. There's this extraordinary, what I hear in your inquiry is this, we have this extraordinary opportunity before us. And let's not just, you know, rejoice in the goodness. Let's rejoice in our fumbling too. It's radical. It's a radical self-love. It's a
bear. I'm trying to cheat up a level as a man who finds himself in a position to teach, as a very flawed man who has the grace of, who's been blessed with by grace with profound flaw,
to learn. Yes.
Yeah, right. That maybe I can, like, cheat myself up some points, not just by trying to be kinder with myself, but if I can encourage other people to do it. Like, if people put themselves in a situation where they would take my advice and I can encourage them, this should be an oxymoron maybe, but to give themselves the grace of forgiveness in that moment that they have seen themselves miss the mark helplessly by the overwhelming momentum of what has come before, and can heroically accept the sensation of gratitude for noticing that maybe if I can get them to do it, if I can get one person to do it, if I can get another person to do it, if I could get five people to
do
it.
You might start doing it.
That somewhere in the great ledger, right, like Ben is collecting points towards some momentum by which it works on him in the great ledger in the sky.
Yeah. And by the way, remember, there's a man named Lorenzo Scupoli who wrote a book called The Spiritual Combat. He was a monk who taught a lot of lay people and then eventually became a hermit and wrote this book. And it's been through 600 editions. And it seems that he is teaching that the lightness of what you're, I just made a boo-boo, I hurt somebody. When we make too much of that boo-boo and we're hard on ourselves, it's a horrific form of self-love and narcissism. It's very interesting. He says, oh, no, don't be too hard on yourself. No, not like that. If you're just offer it to God, I made a boo-boo, and move on. That very lightness of touch around that is precisely what's going to stop you from doing it ultimately. Think about it as a, and this is me just running with Scupoli, think about my son when I would come in at the end of a day and whip him into shape by being harsh. Sure, there'd be quiet, but it would be a false quiet, a false peace. I was able to do whatever, you know, you got to versus, and sometimes there's time for such sort of thing. Rarely, but to come in with love and towards my son, then it creates this quiet and peace that is a deeper one, similar with one's own self. If we're making too much of our bad deeds, there's a certain kind of piteous self-absorption in that. And that's okay too, right? We have to be okay with that. And yet still, though, recognize actually there's just a lightness of touch and just being like, well, moving on. I just made that boo-boo. Now moving on. And of course, there are different degrees, right, of bad deeds.
Yeah.
And then there we need to have some carefulness around how we respond to those deeds. But in general,
I feel like I'm having this, minor epiphany at this moment in my life of the way I've tried to rein myself in from a narcissism that I didn't particularly have. And one of the things that they say someone with low self-esteem can do is, you know, be a perfectionist, right? Anything less than perfect is crap. And then also that there's a tendency to, I don't know, aim high or aim higher than is appropriate or expect more of yourself than is appropriate. Certain clues, you know, like my mom saying to me recently, you know, she's been working with the thought that okay is okay, right? And it should be a bit like big sign to me that my immediate feeling was no, it isn't. It's a tautology. Okay is okay. Yeah. It's really hard to get around that. You can't, like, if you think that okay is not okay, that should be a clue that something's a little
amiss.
Something's funny. Right. If you think good enough is not good enough, that couldn't be right. Technically, you're definitely wrong if you think good enough is not good enough. Right. So what does that mean if I think that? And does it speak to a low self-esteem? But then there's this converse, which I really struggle with. And so at the same time, I say, look, it's a sign. If you think okay is not okay, or you think good enough is not good enough, that should be a sign that there's something there. You should go look into that. There's a saying that I hear people say that I feel like you're hinting towards, that low self-esteem is a kind of pride. You see, that self-deprecation is a kind of pride.
As Shakespeare said it, shame is pride's cloak. Yeah, yeah.
This is
this
is hard for me. And yeah. There's something rings true about it, and I've heard people say it over and over again. And the fact that my mind won't quite grab it or won't quite grasp it makes me very self-suspicious about what I'm rejecting, what my mind can't seem to sink its teeth into. Like maybe it touches too close to the bone when I feel like, yeah, that's probably right. Or I accept, like, it's like a platitude. Like people say it all the time. And you're sort of saying this a little bit that
I am, yeah.
Being hard on ourself, making too much of falling short of the mark, is a kind of self aggrandizement. How's it work? I can't quite. I've struggled to get there.
How is that a self aggrandizement? I guess it's just a heavy-handedness relative to focus on self. It's kind of a it, there is a real beautiful thing to have a sort of humor around one's shortcomings. I was at a party the other night, which I haven't done for so long, and it was with close relatives, and there was this fellow there who said something like, "Well, you're a phony," and he didn't say phony. The woman heard it as that, and then she said, "Finally, I'm exposed," and I just thought, and he said it, and the tone was such that I thought there might be offense taken because I heard it as she heard it, and I thought, what a lovely response. I mean, it's sort of like the antithesis of phony is to say, oh, finally, I'm exposed. Here I am. The cat's out of the bag. And why do I say that? Just that there was just a lightness with the way she looked back at her own ego and herself. And that was sort of shown in that instant. So, but yeah, right.
Like constantly waiting to be exposed. I have such a strong, you know, whatever this, that they use the term imposter syndrome, right? Like I have a very strong imposter syndrome, you know, like I'm running from people finding out that I have no spiritual achievements, no right to be teaching anything, no right to be doing any of the things that people let me do. And it's just a matter of time till people find out. And so there's this tension in me where
you're saying you want that exposure?
No, please no.
I misunderstood.
I don't know what I'm saying. No, I don't know that you misunderstood. I'm dancing around the question of whether or not I want that exposure. Maybe I do. Those moments those moments are incredible. I mean, in the rare moments where I feel like I have been utterly, perfectly naked to the bone, to my innermost heart before someone else, it was a relief.
Yeah, exactly.
Are rare.
And I would say that syndrome brought into the light makes us very grace prone. To narrow down to this after 40 or so minutes of talking, I mean, here's the rub: to wish our foibles to be broadcasted would be a very quick way to overcome foibles. And you know, well, what would it be for the content of our minds to be in like a megaphone in the house? Siri, what is Kevin thinking right now? The whole family could hear. It'd be just terrible. That is just what a heinous. Oh my gosh! Then you would know. Then everyone would know. And it's almost like the solution in some of the monotheistic paths, in the Sufi path, for example, is God hears your every thought. There's no hiding from reality, from truth itself. So it might as well let those of us who are part of this impermanent world passing in and out of life and death, might as well just let everyone know ahead of time. And that strangely does for me make a person, in a sense, you kind of get to teach them or something. You get to admit oneself to be an imposter, to not know, and to say it up front makes me feel very safe with you, that you're so willing to go there with me. It makes me feel, or just even how you started this conversation, like I really want the students in the class to not make the boo-boos I made and still keep making. And really, by saying these things, may it, you know, create a momentum in myself. Please help.
I'm furtively, right, trying to reveal myself to like the, you know, the three and a half people that listen to this podcast.
Furtively.
So that I'm outed.
Might be two people. I don't know, 2.2.
Right. Yeah, right. Yeah, totally. That point two, that's the, they're, yeah, I, yeah. I am trying to be, and I try to aggressively, oh, but I'm still scared to do it. And I don't do it totally. And I know that there are some things, it's cute, right? I don't even trust myself in doing it. Like I still reveal what's safe. Right. I still know what I held back. I still know I didn't reveal. I'm still aware of the way that I put that was safe for me, that didn't say all the things about what I'm not yet ready to reveal that would also be okay, but I'm not sure. I don't know how safe I feel. And we dance, I don't know, I guess to try to create tension in the conversation. I think there's this question of self-love and that, right, it's evil twin or something.
Yes,
right?
And it's strange that as self-love grows, and I would say, I have to say, love of one's true self, it's delicate, as opposed to love of the false self that's spun around anxieties and perhaps illusions, but that as a healthy self-love grows, confession becomes more and more a joy, and they seem related. And it is sad that we live in a world where there's been an abuse of confession and a loss of the nature of it, such that even in the Protestant or Episcopal Anglican Union, we just do a general confession and we don't go to a mother or a father and say, "Mother, Father, I have sinned. You know, I have done some stuff, boo-boos." Or that there's children in the Catholic Church having to make up sins. They don't go to the rejoicinal before the confessional. Like a six-year-old Italian girl should be sitting around thinking about what she did wrong, frankly, or viewing a bloodied man on a cross. It's like, it's worse than pornography. It shouldn't be. There's something, the Catholic Church is beautiful. Confession is at the root. Every practice, Sufi practices that I've engaged in, Buddhist practices that I've engaged in, just a little bit that I know about these practices, Christian practices that I've engaged in, all those labels not really meaning much, only to the extent that they all seem to begin with confession. And that seems to loosen the ground of the heart and make it susceptible to the seeds of God and to them being watered. There's something, and it's not an act of self-hate. It's one of the deepest acts of self-love to go to a father and in confession and in that holy secret relation, in that booth, share those things and get them off of our heart and share them. And as soon as they come into light, just like therapy really is the modern answer to confession. And perhaps a really better venue, you know. I don't know, or it seems related that much of just bringing it into the light seems to heal it. And my son, who's just gone off, I just said goodbye to him. He's just gone on his odyssey out west. He's doing a sweat lodge with some Tiwa elders outside of Taos in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, and is in the sweat lodge. And the elder says, you know, bless the rock people, bless the rocks, the heat, the blessed heat from Great Spirit, bless the rock people. And then he said, oh, bless yourself, beautiful beings in this sweat, love yourself. Oh, just, and Sam's describing it. And it just, there was people crying in the sweat. And the second is bless the people. And the third is bless the people in the tent. You bless the rocks, you bless yourself in love. And then bless everyone in the tent, and then all beings. These are the four things you do in preparation for exercising what needs to get out through this sweat. And there's something in these methodologies that in all these faiths and ways that seem to always begin with this healthy self-love and opening up to boo-boos made. Mm-hmm. And that's profound to me. But like you said, we tend to share what we want to share, and then we hold back in places, and we have to ask for help.
We don't got
to
be all the same, right? And I have this fundamental suspicion that has lasted through my life, that there's this most intimate place within us that that we most fear sharing with one another, where we are the least different from one another, were we ever to see it and and reveal it. But at the same time, I also find that there's this tension between self-love and pride, of course, wherein I can be, right, self-cherishing, right, as we might like translate Chen Zin or something from the Tibetan. Right, that I'm looking out for number one. I'm making sure I get the biggest slice of the pie. And that's a sort of what we might think of as self-love. But then in my effort to counter that, I encounter it in an unwise way, that I am afraid to be kind or loving with myself. Giving myself the biggest slice of pizza is not, it's not being loving with myself. I mean, that's not loving per se. It's not,
right.
It's just, you know, I don't know. I don't know what you call that instead, but still I practice this habit of being suspicious at myself for wanting this biggest slice of pizza that then when I'm alone in myself and I've missed the mark, I don't want to be too easy on myself. You see, I got to, okay, be easy on yourself. That's cool. You know, and I'm going to tell other people to be easy on myself, on themselves. Cute. Also feel free, other people be easy on myself, but be easy on yourself because I love them. And I feel safe in loving others in a way that I don't feel safe in loving myself. Oh. And it feels real easy to me to look out to someone and say, you know, I'm so grateful for you. I love you. Partially because I want to be loved back. And it feels safer for me to be loved from without than within. And so it feels like I'm attracted to loving other people. And then maybe they'll love me back. And then that feels like a safe avenue for me to receive love. Because if I receive it direct from myself, then... who knows what kind of self-indulgence and chicanery I'll get up to.
And that's an important thing to ask, because I want to say, which self are we feeding? I do feel like there does have to be that distinction going on, and that's very fraught. Like, I don't know what it is to feed the quote unquote right. Now you're telling me feed the right self and starve the wrong self. Oh, great. Okay. and is the spiritual life then the ability to parse, the ability to see what is stained and unstained, to pull on the Abhidharma Kosha, because an engaged, enlightened self-love would choose that which is ultimately best for the true self, if you will. It would not be in contradiction to the needs of others. It would seem like you would have the biggest piece and they would too. You know, like, what is that? What does that look like? Can we strive for that? And then I think, well, sitting with these Tibetans who came here 30 years ago, you know, 21 people in Asha's big house, my mother-in-law's house in town, and now they've grown to 160 and they need a temple. And we picked up these huge 1,008 malas from the Bodhi tree. And it's truly from that area, because he was a tour guide. And he's like, Jamyang was a tour guide there. And he looked, and Pema and these Rinzen, these beings who came to my porch, they're looking at the bees and going, oh my gosh, and seeing triangles in them and a little dot. And then we start holding all this huge mala together, and they're doing mantra. And then I inquire, well, what are you doing? And Jamyang's like, praying for all beings, for everyone here, myself, and everyone here on the porch, and then for all beings, kind of like the sweat, and that my son was engaged in. And then I thought, well, why? Why for all beings? Like, we don't even know. He goes, well, isn't the mind, in a way, true mind, isn't it infinite? Isn't there an infinite quality to mind? Not mind like the conceptual nature, but to the nature of mind. And isn't love by nature infinite? So isn't mind and love in this kind of dance? Isn't there a way in which this enlightened self-love is a love for all beings? And that's not what he said. This is now bringing it back, but he was equating the infinitude of love and the infinitude of mind and sitting there and doing mantra together, which just, I think, kind of went over my head. It does seem to relate to this discussion today,
yeah,
in some way. I don't know. I'm on the fringes here of
not necessarily. Not too bad. It does seem that that self-treatment and other treatment are linked in a way that I have a tendency to be in denial about. This idea that I can give true love to others without giving it to myself. It seems highly
kind of nuts.
Dubious.
Dubious.
Yeah, right. No,
but,
you're probably
but
right.
It does seem like a broken child, emotionally abused, a child who... We all go through stuff, and that sometimes only by loving others, just by for a moment, just cooking a meal when you're a kid, or that just made you feel just a little glimmer of love of self. Somehow, for the momentum to come, I don't know which comes first, or whether it's simultaneous, a love of other, love of self. You can't love others without loving self. Yeah, but I can't love myself if I don't love others. And then this simultaneous arising comes up, and then I don't understand that too well. I know as a kid, I just hated myself. And I was told that I was selfish. I believed it. I believed it truly. And so when I could do something for someone, just for a second, I felt moments in my growing up of like, oh, I'm a good boy. I'm good. And it was always such, it came as such an incredible relief to just stop this almost subconscious, low self-esteem chatter that just was running in my mind. And then I'm told by a man named Jomyang, you know, the Tibetan word for manjushi, for wisdom, that there's something about the infinite nature of mind, the nature of mind, not what's in mind or your mind, the nature of mind and love. There's something in those infinitudes that touch. And love of all beings is love of the self. That's not something he said. That's something I'm extrapolating, and vice versa. So it just, and how that fits together, I do not know.
I know, it's a struggle. And even when I talk about doing things for other people, it's always been very clear to me, the self-interest in that. Like I want them to be happy, and I want to be good, and I want to love them. I want them to love me back. And I see that self-interest, you know, I'm still trying to get something. I still want them to like me. And then I'm suspicious of myself for it. And I don't know that it has to happen, that one thing has to happen in a particular order, because they feed back and forth. And don't worry, because I'm underdeveloped in both skills. So I can work in both arenas to try and reinforce one another, to love other people better, to love myself better, to love other people in order to love myself better, to love myself better in order to love other people better. And I'm trying. And part of it is this patience with what are you going to do? You know, what are you going to do, Ben? I mean, yeah, okay, you acted like that. And what are you going to do? It was take it easy, bud. You know, like that's the momentum of how you were going to act today is really big. It's quite big. And whether we call that grace or not is a really interesting, you know, question.
You mean the knowledge? Wait. The knowledge of the momentum being grace, or the momentum itself?
The momentum itself is big. How much goes into the momentum of my behavior today is big. And
my instinct goes, be aware of the momentum that is driving others, and let that build up in me patience, but be aware that that momentum towards something that is going to harm myself and others, I want to take out the sword, Ben. I want to be the Manjushri with sword. I want to wield the Bodhisattva sword and be like very lenient with others. And then like, no, you may not come in. You are not welcome. Like, and then, okay, well, that sometimes works, but then sometimes that's disastrous, which is what we're talking about.
Right. Only grace can wield the sword. You cannot wield that sword, right? And I'm calling it grace, right? Of course, I'm making some concession in this by calling it grace, right? With a self-sympathy too. Of course, I'm trying it on sincerely when I do that. I'm not just
right. It's not sophistic. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, it's not. It's not.
Yeah,
right? I see a coldness to that momentum also potentially, that it's not only some momentum allows me to be able to cut out ignorant self-interest. And I don't, you know, same thing with talking about a true self or a false self. You know, of course I'm not entirely comfortable with that.
Nor am I.
But then what? So what would I replace it with? I don't know. You got your false self, you got your mirror self, you could apply the words true self to the lack of a false self superimposed upon the mirror self. It gets tedious a little.
It does. Hard. Or we could talk about specifics. What self would that, what's the false self? The self that gets pumped up when it feels some kind of refuge in worldly honor and recognition, the self that gets pumped up and reified when it identifies with its really nice vehicle as almost an extension of the self that when a friend comes over and looks at the two jackets I have and has one, I don't want to give the jacket away. The self that when you're sitting down to a meal and you realize there's only really enough salad for the two beings, but there's three beings at the table, you delight in letting other people have the salad. That's the self. Like, I want to say
self that thinks that you decided to be kind today or not.
Right. And that's where Jesus says, says to Nicodemus, do not call me good. Only my Father in heaven is good. But the difficulty with that, and I think this is what's hard for people, it's not like we become zombies and we're all the same.
The difficulty in that is that it's not true that you didn't decide either exactly.
Right. There's perhaps a collusion of wills, if you will. There's almost like a co-creation. Perhaps, what language to use?
Yeah, I don't know.
The grace of God and your own effort coming together is a collusion. But the strange thing is that when I know I am loved, held in love, returned to love, love irrespective of my worth, my will is liberated to do good. It doesn't make sense. When I don't see myself as the primary doer, there's a healing of that self that it doesn't make, it seems contradictory or something, or maybe not. Maybe that doesn't seem contradictory.
So we make a prayer, you know, like, I don't know what to do, but pray that, that it goes differently today. And I don't know if I can make it go differently today. I don't know that I can't either. In some ways, it seems totally wrong to say that I could do anything about it. And in some ways, it seems equally wrong to say that there's...
I couldn't do anything about it.
Right, yeah. Both of them seem exactly wrong from a certain vantage. And that's a big tension in me. And so I hope it goes differently. And I hope that I don't take more credit for it than is safe for me to take for it, to build up some expectation because.
And I hope I hope that I also take some credit so that it builds up a good sense of self and to draw on our our Trappist brother Thomas Merton, welcome to the existential situation of being human. The tightrope you just described is a holy one. It's sacred.
Yeah.
That tension is kind of being in the game, in a sense. That's part of the.
And so I just want to say to my friends, in these classes and whatnot, just like take it easy. Like we're gonna try, but take it easy. What we're asking is a lot, and it's gonna work or it's not gonna work, and it's not clear how much power you have over it. But here we are together, and for whatever reason, we find ourselves together asking to be kinder to others, asking to be kinder for ourselves, asking for the grace to be kind to ourselves and one another in the right way, which I feel very suspicious of that.
Oh boy.
And how to feed the version of myself, how to love the right version of myself without getting drawn into loving the wrong me.
And also knowing that we maybe can't even parse that. But what you said about taking it easy.
Take it easy, man.
A Sufi teacher of mine for 3 years. Beautiful. Shweya bishweya.
Shweya
bishweya.
I only know the phrase through you.
Shweya bishweya.
I only know it through you. I only know the phrase through you. But I know the phrase because... It's good. Because I know it through you, because I know through this.
It feels like what it is, right? Just you used to look at me trying so hard.
Take it easy, man. It's okay. We're trying and it's amazing. And to see ourselves trying and to notice that we're trying, like that's, it's gotta be a grace. I mean, or it's just such a lovely thing to call it.
Yeah. Yeah,
and I don't know what's gotta be, but it's a blessing. And how do we feed that momentum? Do I have any wiggle room at all to water the sprouts that are coming up purdy?
Well, may your class make all you and your students accident prone to grace. And I have to believe we're doing this podcast and speaking with each other and doing what we do because, damn it, there is wiggle room. Or else, I want to just like I want to wave the flag of there's wiggle room. Lord, can we do things that make us accident prone to your grace? I have to say yes, or else I don't know. I'll just go eat like 10 pieces of pizza.
That does sound good.
That does actually sound good. I mean,
maybe 9. I'm not a monster. maybe 11. It depends on when you catch me. Yeah. I have to go. And this was nice and felt fruitful for me today.
Me too.
I love you, dude.
I love you, Ben.
Talk to you soon.
Later, bro.